From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Auto executives from Detroit's Big Three go back to Capitol Hill and plea for a lifeline to federal lawmakers. And could a new bailout proposal help curb home foreclosures? Our Reporters Roundtable is here to look at the week's top headlines. And joining us today are Sarah Webster, the automotive editor for the Detroit Free Press, and Theola LeBay DeBose, a staff writer for the Washington Post. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thank you, Tony.
Let's begin with this. There isn't enough support in the U.S. Senate right now to pass a bailout. The heads of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler drove to the nation's capital this week to plea for $34 billion in loans from the federal government. They didn't fare so well on their first trip, and this time are coming with concessions and hat in hand. Theola, are their prospects for success any better now?
There was the statement today by President Bush basically saying that there needs to be some action taken. Bush has always been very strategic about when he weighs in on these issues, especially when his days in office are really dwindling. But I think that obviously lawmakers will take that statement, however brief, to heart. And I think that obviously part of this is theater, but part of this is also really asking the hard questions, because we are talking about billions of public dollars.
Sarah, let's talk about your paper, because it has dedicated an entire front page to editorials on the auto industry. And I'd like to also ask you about the reaction to all of this from the people who are directly impacted, the people in Detroit. Now, your paper's website ran an automated cartoon today, which I think is pretty instructive about the way that Detroiters are feeling. It starts with the voices of someone asking for money for a bailout. But the irony is, it isn't the automakers, it's the U.S. government coming to the automakers for help. And the time in the cartoon is 1941, right after Pearl Harbor. Let's listen.
Look, we know you're in a death struggle with Japan, but you're asking for an umpteen billion-dollar commitment from us. How do we know you won't be back in a couple of months, asking for even more? We have no assurances you'll ever pay us back. Besides, the fix you're in is a result of your own failure to plan ahead.
So, sorry, Congress. We're not going to retool our factories to build tanks and planes for you. Japan's your problem.
So, Sarah, do the people there feel that they are owed this assistance?
I don't think there's any sense of entitlement. I think that there are so many feelings here right now, as you might imagine, and one of those is just fear. If the federal government doesn't do this, I think the people in Michigan, not just Detroit, have seen the future. We've seen what is yet to come for this country. I mean, if you look at a map, and we have an interactive map on our website that I encourage people to look at, you can click state by state and see how many jobs. I mean, you're talking about really decimating the whole Midwest, California, Texas, places where there are just thousands and thousands of automotive jobs. Even Alaska has 2,500 automotive jobs. And I think that people here are just scared that maybe Americans have forgotten how threaded into the fabric of life the auto industry is.
Well, Theola, this morning new job numbers were released. In November, more than 500,000 jobs were cut. The unemployment rate is the highest it has been in 34 years. It stands at 6.7% currently. How much are workers willing to sacrifice to keep their jobs?
It's a very, very tough climate right now. There are some holiday parties coming up for me personally at the newspaper, and the word that I am hearing a lot is potluck, not expecting that someone is going to come and bail you out and, you know, throw some sort of lavish gathering. I think that the fear that obviously folks working in the industry in the Midwest, people have, different aspects of that fear in their personal lives. And so what you're going to see is, and we have already seen this, retail shopping is down, Walmart only really is up, cash is king all of a sudden. The fear is really widespread in large and small ways.
You know, Sarah, we heard just today the head of the UAW saying that he is willing to go back to the table to give concessions so long as everyone is at the table. In his words, that would include the suppliers to the auto industry as well. Do you think that labor is ready to really give back significantly in order to get through this crisis?
Well, labor has already given back significantly, and even on, you know, a few days ago, they held a press conference and gave back even more, even without the automakers directly asking them to. They have repeatedly given back, and right now, the wage difference is actually very small between the UAW represented workers and those who are employed by the foreign automakers in America. It's about $4 a difference in some places. I think that everyone's willing to sacrifice to make sure that this industry doesn't fail. And I think it's also important to note that even in the cartoon that you were sharing, that the government has come to Detroit many times in our past and asked for Detroit's help, asked the help of these industries. And these industries have stepped up and they've helped make this country better. And now Detroit's really asking for a hand. And if the government gives that hand, I think that it is an investment in America. Our full-page editorial today says invest in America because we believe here, and we believe it deeply, that if that money is given to Detroit, we can actually be part of the economic recovery that this country can have. And we think that it could be robust again.
Let's move from the crisis on wheels to the crisis at the curb. I'm talking about the mortgage crisis now. Top officials at Treasury are pushing a plan to subsidize mortgage rates at 4.5% for 30-year mortgages. They hope that this will trigger home buying and ease the housing markets, but this low interest rate would only apply to people with good credit. It would also not apply to people who would like to refinance their homes. Let me ask you, Theola, what would this impact be on people who are in danger of losing their homes if this were to take place?
It's a very difficult thing to say now, and I think the reason why there's been so much discussion on this important topic about foreclosures, saving homes, obviously for the economic reasons in terms of being intricately tied to the recovery of the nation. But essentially, when you have the government really entering into this sector, you have the federal government essentially trying to figure out how much they decide who is worthy to have a low interest loan, whether it's refinanced, whether it's someone who has good credit. And those are very difficult questions because that's the reason why the private sector is private. That's the reason why you go to a broker or you apply directly to Fannie Mae. But all of that system has been turned upside down. And so I think what you're seeing is the government really struggling in their role to sort of figure out how are we to set some guidelines that essentially do not punish people for paying their mortgages and then do not perhaps, you know, give people incentive not to pay?
There's one other topic I'd like to get as we bring reporters, our reporters roundtable to a close for this week, and I'm going to address it to you, Sarah. It's this. President-elect Obama's cabinet, he's nominated so far 3 women, 2 African-Americans. He's also nominated the most prominent Hispanic politician, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, for Secretary of State. But here's where I want to go. Xavier Becerra, a congressman from L.A., is Obama's choice for U.S. trade rep. But unlike Attorney General nominee Eric Holder, Holder, Becerra has some political baggage from a controversial presidential pardon during the Clinton administration. The question is, who do you see of the cabinet picks so far who may have trouble with their confirmation?
Well, I think it's, you know, difficult to say. It really depends on the makeup of, you know, the congressional leadership and, you know, who they want to go after. I mean, sometimes, you know, they just let things sail through and other times they decide they're going to, you know, really go after people. I think in this case, it's, you know, the trade representatives, if Obama's trade policies are to roll the clock back, I think that members of Congress may be resistant to that.
What do you see, Theola? Are you hearing names that are going to be red flags? Eric Holder is one that we've heard publicly so far, at least. I don't know if there are others that you've heard.
The buzz in Washington isn't about specific names, but, you know, every year or every 4 years, it just holds true that there is always a dud. I mean, that's just sort of like straight math, like a math problem. If you've got 12 people, someone is going to mess up. Someone else may not make it, so on and so forth. But I think still, certainly, even though the campaign is over and that Obama essentially is splitting time between Washington and Chicago, there's still a bit of a honeymoon in terms of, oh, this person got named today. Isn't that great? Oh, that person got named today. And so I think perhaps, you know, going into January, maybe after the official swearing in, obviously, which is sort of, you know, here we're kind of gearing up to cover this big event. I think that's where you'll see, once things get down to the hard work of governing, where some of those issues are possibly going to come up.
Really quickly, in 10 seconds or less, is he more centrist than we thought he was as a candidate now that he is naming people and giving an idea of what direction he's going in?
I think that that is still in the eye of the beholders.
Thea LaSera, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sarah Webster, the automotive editor for the Detroit Free Press, and Theola LaBey-DeBose, a staff writer for the Washington Post. She joined us from the Post studios in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. From music to fashion to the movies and television programs we watch, the signs of a multicultural America are everywhere, and the nation is growing more diverse every day. More than 1 million immigrants flood into the country each year, bringing with them traditions, languages, cultures, and religions from around the world. As they become neighbors, friends, and co-workers, how do these different cultures interact? Today, we kick off our month-long series on multiculturalism. Is America really a melting pot of cultures, or do our differences keep us apart? Ronald Takaki is Professor Emeritus of Ethnic Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. An updated edition of his landmark book, A Different Mirror, A History of Multicultural America, hits shelves this week. Also joining the conversation, Jen Chow. She is the founder and executive director of Swirl, a national multi-ethnic organization. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks.
Hello.
Ronald, let me begin with you. In your book, A Different Mirror, you write, America does not belong to one race or group. Americans have been constantly redefining their national identity from the moment of first contact on the Virginia shore. Explain what's important, why it's important to understand America's diverse multicultural history.
Well, when you think about America, we are a nation peopled by the world. And the victory of Barack Obama reaffirms this fact about who we are as Americans. We didn't just come from Europe. We also came from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the North American continent itself. But the problem is this. There is what I call the master narrative of American history, the familiar but mistaken story that this country was settled by European immigrants and that Americans are white or European in ancestry, and that names like Obama and Takaki are funny names. But Barack Obama and also this organization called Swirl is saying, hey, wait a minute, we came from many different places and we're all American. So this is a moment for us to redefine the national identity.
Do you think Americans don't already know this?
No, Americans don't know this because think about it. They take U.S. history courses, but in these U.S. history courses, what have they learned about Asian Americans or Puerto Ricans or Chicanos or the native peoples of this country or even African Americans? Nothing or next to nothing. And so Americans are not thinking about who is an American. It's in the air. It's an unacknowledged assumption that American means white or European in ancestry.
Do you subscribe to that theory, Jen?
I completely agree with Professor Takaki. I think that there's still a lot of conversation that needs to happen so that we are on the same page. And one of the things that SWIRL actually tries to do is just that. I think one of the problematic dynamics in this country is that so many of us are willing to talk about race and identity with our own. And we don't have a chance to dispel some of these myths and, you know, right some of the wrongs and challenge assumptions when we're only speaking in our separate pockets. So we really try to bring people together to have honest and direct conversations about race and, you know, as Professor Takaki is saying, to throw out some of our old and tired ways of discussing it.
Well, let's have one of those frank discussions right now surrounding Barack Obama, because he is a biracial, bicultural man, and yet he has been identified as being the first black president of the United States. How do you explain that, Ronald?
Yes, well, Barack Obama is a victim of the one-drop rule. In this country, if you have a drop of black blood, you are identified as black. But most people don't know the historical origins of the one-drop rule. In my book, I point out that in the 17th century, Virginia planter elites enacted two anti-miscegenation laws. The first law declared that a child of a slave mother and a white father would be a slave. The second law declared that the child of a white mother and a black father would also be a slave. So you have the stigmatization of the color black. To be black meant to be a slave. To be a slave meant to be black. And that law, those two laws have ricocheted down America's history until this very day, until the 21st century. And we find this in the way Barack Obama has been defined as black.
Now, doesn't Barack Obama, Jen, doesn't Barack Obama have a choice in terms of how he wants to be perceived publicly? He could just as easily, could he not, have considered himself white as he considers himself to be black, if he's half and half?
I don't know if people would accept that, Tony.
Well, I'm asking about Barack Obama. What he could, does he have a choice in that regard? Or well, is he culturalized, if there is such a word, to be black because of what the professor just described?
I absolutely believe he has a choice, and that's something that I have fought for as a mixed-race activist for all of these years, and that's something that SWIRL very much stands by, is that mixed-race people should be able to identify as they so choose. The follow-up question to that, though, is will people buy that? And what are we okay with? I think one of the tensions, and I'd love to hear Professor Takaki's thoughts on this, is when we know where we want to get to, we have a vision of how things should be, and we know that we should be able to be in a place where Barack Obama can identify as mixed race and where everybody absolutely accepts that without any question or challenge. We want to get to that place, but we are living in a very real situation where that is not acceptable. And in many ways, stemming from this one-drop rule, for Barack Obama to say, "I'm mixed race," is him denying his blackness. I think that's how a lot of people will see it. And so I think this country still really struggles to accept mixed race identity as a real identity, and mixed race people who are in the spotlight, their identity is continually picked apart. Their identity is always up for debate. So it's really this tension, I think, between, okay, where are we right now and what will people accept, and where are we trying to get to, and how can we actually challenge some of the current assumptions?
That's very interesting. This whole talk about multiculturalism, we hear it all the time. We see it in books. We see it in papers. It's taught in the universities. But is it really real, Professor? Is there really such a thing as multiculturalism?
Well, I'd like to answer Jen's question first, though. Where do we want to get to? Well, think about Frederick Douglass, who was the son of a slave mother and a white father, his very own master. And Douglass refused to identify himself as black. He said, "I belong to a blended race." Mm-hmm. That was his identity, a blended race. And think about Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods doesn't say, "I'm a black king of golf." He calls himself a Caucasian, Caucasian, black and Asian. He acknowledges his Thai mother.
And he gets teased for saying that.
Yeah, but he's insisting that he's not African American, you see. And I respect and I honor Tiger Woods for making that kind of brave stand.
Well, my question to you then, going back, is whether or not, given the realities of a Barack Obama or a Tiger Woods, or as Jen was describing, is the whole conversation about multiculturalism, is it real? Is it substantive, given the fact that we have these long-standing ideas about how we see ourselves and how we see others?
Yeah, well, it's happening, and it's the handwriting is on the wall. In California already, whites have become a minority. And the U.S. Census has projected that whites will become a minority by the year 2042. So just the changing colors of the American people will redefine who is an American and will spark this debate over multiculturalism.
Let me just say,
I see a bright future for us.
Hold on. I'm going to come back to you, Jen, in just a second.
Okay.
If you're just joining us, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai. We're joined with Ronald Takaki, a professor emeritus of ethnic studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He is also the author of A Different Mirror, A Historical Multicultural America. We're also joined by Jen Chow, the founder and executive director of SWIRL, a national multi-ethnic organization. And we're talking about multiculturalism. Is it real or is it not? Jen, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we have a really far way to go. And I think part of it is that we need to redefine what multiculturalism means to us. I think that a lot of people will hear that and think about that very superficial way of celebrating ethnicities or cultures that really is sort of a cover for let's just tolerate each other because we're all living together. And I think multiculturalism, because of that, has a lot of really negative connotations to people who actually do care about diversity. So I think part of it is needing to redefine that. And I'm hoping that Barack Obama is going to keep the conversation on the table. The one thing that I'm really troubled by in the wake of his becoming president-elect is that people are saying that we're now in this post-race world, that because we have this black or mixed-race president, that now we are free from racism. And that is a frightening thought. It is not anywhere close to where we are. I wish it was, but, you know, if you have any doubts, check out some of our urban public schools across the country and see that we have major, major gaps to fill. We are not anywhere close to being in this post-racial world.
Ronald, one of the things that Jen mentioned was the topic of diversity, and I'd like to get your response to this because sometimes, many times, when the topic of diversity comes up, people start, the eyes start rolling, things of that sort. How do you get folks engaged in this subject?
Well, I become a teacher. I teach them the history, the true history of the peoples of the United States of America, and how we the people, you know, that was the nation of we the people that was founded by the signers of the Declaration of Independence was supposed to be a white man's country. But minorities took the ideas and the principles of the Declaration of Independence and made them theirs. And they said, we the people have to include us. But with multiculturalism is this path toward grounding us in this reality of our diversity. Multiculturalism is not a fad. It's not going to go away. And multiculturalism is not political correctness. Multiculturalism is a serious effort to redefine who is an American.
Well, Jen, some people think, though, that it's not their responsibility to educate mm-hmm. others about race or ethnicity. Whose responsibility is it?
It's all of ours. It really is. And one of the things that I have really been thinking a lot about is how, for the most part in this country, issues around race, issues around identity are left up to the people of color. Or it's a situation where white folks are made to feel nervous about these conversations, made to feel like they don't know anything, they have nothing to contribute, and people of color are assumed to be the experts. And I think that there are a lot of false assumptions that come with that type dichotomy. And one of the things we're going to have to do is to put those aside and say, you know what, this is not going to get better unless we're all at the table together, and where people are able to bring their experiences and where everyone is respected and valued. We don't have that now. And I think that's part of the reason why, like I said before, we're talking about race and identity in our own separate communities.
What if I'm not interested in other people's communities or other people's cultures or other people's food or music, and I just want to be around people who look like me and think like me and talk like me? What about that?
I mean, that's your prerogative, and I personally am not going to do anything to force you out of that corner. I don't think that that's a realistic way to live moving forward, just as we're talking about how this nation is becoming more and more diverse, but I understand why people might want to do that. There's a security in community, and there's a security in people like you, but I think what you miss then is realizing, guess what? There are other people like you in different communities, and you miss the richness of this country if you stay only with people who reflect exactly your experience.
Ronald, let me ask you, as we bring our conversation to a close, what has integration done to the concept of multiculturalism in terms of how young people, a younger generation, has come up with a completely different paradigm than older folks have with regard to race and multiculturalism and diversity?
Well, I think integration now means an integration of our different cultures, where we can be as individuals and as communities more than our ethnic identities and our ethnic cultures, our specific ethnic identities and ethnic cultures. We can become multicultural. And this is the rich opportunity that America offers today in the 21st century. There's a lot of sharing that we can do with one another. But we have to remember that we are a diverse people and we all belong to one nation. We share a common citizenship, and that is the reason why we also have to interact with one another.
It would seem that because we're in a global economy and a global culture, that the old rules with regard to multiculturalism are being expanded and are evolving. Would you agree with that, Jen?
I think that we're in the right direction, as Professor Takaki said before, but I still think we have a way to go. We're still holding on to things like the one-drop rule, as he explained. We're still holding on to our old patterns. And one of the reasons why I'm so excited about Barack Obama is because I'm hoping that his mere presence and him bringing up issues around race will keep it on the table. I think that our country sort of perks up when something major happens around race, and then have all of these conversations and stop and wait for the next huge event. And so we haven't really been building this momentum, and I'm talking about, you know, a national conversation. I don't think we're building this momentum that we need in order to get to a better place and a little bit farther from this old way of talking about race and multiculturalism.
It's a fascinating conversation, and I appreciate the time that both of you have given us to come on News and Notes and talk about it. We'd like to invite you to come back and expand the conversation and perhaps include some other ethnic groups to be a part of the conversation. You both are Asian American. I'm African American. We need to have some Latinos, and we need to have some Anglo-Americans on here as well. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ronald Takaki is Professor Emeritus of Ethnic Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. A revised edition of his book, A Different Mirror, A History of Multicultural America, hits shelves next week. He was at the studios on campus. Also, Jen Chow, the founder and executive director of Swirl, a national multi-ethnic organization. She was at our studios in New York. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. The stock market is in steady decline, and the gold market is unstable, so could investing in fine art be a safe place to put your money? Miami Beach is hosting Art Basel this weekend. It is the most prestigious art fair in the country, and some say even in this economy, art investments are still thriving. NPR's Farai Today is there. She joins us now. Hey, Farai.
Hey, Tony.
Listen, school us, will you please? Art Basel, what is it?
Art Basel is, it's the equivalent, the way I like to explain it, it's Fashion Week for art. It is Miami and Miami Beach parties, a main installation at the South Beach Convention Center, satellite parties. Last night, Russell Simmons threw a big party, and it was really fabulous. And, you know, one of those things where, you know, it was the mix of celebrities and artists.
You know, I know that black artists, Farai, are beginning to shine like never before in the art world. Names like Kara Walker, Lorna Simpson, Kehinde Wiley are getting marquee billing now. And one of the exciting exhibitions at Art Basel this year is called 30 Americans, right? What is that?
Well, 30 Americans is an exhibit by the Rubel family. And the Rubels are a couple who they managed, you know, without a lot of history of collecting art, to collect some of the best artists in the world, including Basquiat. And then they went on to just keep collecting. And 30 Americans is all black American artists. And the reason they called it 30 Americans was just because blackness is Americanness, and it's a really fantastic moment.
Is this artwork something that reaches across the black community, or do you have to be wealthy in order to afford it? How much do these things cost? Give us some idea.
Well, some of them are six figures. But, you know, I think that art is accessed in a lot of ways. You don't have to buy it to access it. It's like you don't have to own a television station or a radio station to watch or listen. And so one thing that's happening, I think, is that particularly when you have people like Russell Simmons embracing the art world, it crosses over. And a lot of people, for example, NBA stars are starting to collect contemporary black art. And, of course, all of these artists are people who don't just get a feature, you know, in the black art world, but in the art world at large. I want to tell you, and I know this is a surprise, I actually have two of the artists with me, Noah Davis and Hank Willis Thomas. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to pass the mic, so to speak, very quickly. I know this is a surprise, but Noah just got married yesterday.
Oh.
There was such good energy here. He got married. But Noah, give me just a brief taste of what you consider your work to be like.
My work is it's just painting. It's with limited amount of resources, trying to make work that conveys. I don't know. That's actually a really tough question. I'm sorry. Who do I consider a big influence on my work? I guess there's a lot of German painters that have a huge influence on me, and like Marlene Dumas. Sorry.
You know, I think that you know, again, to have people who have a broad sense, because, you know, as black folks, you have people like James Baldwin in literature who lived abroad and traveled abroad, and I think this is a continuation of that tradition of internationalism, where these artists are showing internationally but also drawing international influence. If I can give you one more quick taste, Hank Willis Thomas is someone who, I think his signature work is a visual of a black man's head with the Nike swoosh on it. Can you just explain why you did that?
Sure. That image was part of a project called Branded, where I was interested in looking at the way the black body has been commodified presently and also in historical terms, and looking at the way slaves were branded as a sign of ownership. And today we live in a state of branded consciousness.
So, Tony, it's really fantastic.
For one really quick question for you. Is art appreciating in value still, even though the economy is down?
Oh, absolutely. One of the artists here is a woman named Micheline Thomas, and according to reports here, she had four works sell for $35,000 each. And this is someone who's one of the younger artists who's emerging, and I think that's an incredible testament to how this work is doing.
Farai, thank you very much. Thank both of the artists for stopping by.
Thank you.
Farai Jadeh is the host, of course, of News & Notes and a fine art connoisseur. She will be back in this chair on Monday. O.J. Simpson denied bail and a judge sentencing him to 15 years in prison for his armed robbery, kidnapping, and assault convictions. Is it just our imagination, or are we seeing more black faces in the fashion magazines these days? Could we call it the Michelle Obama effect? And the Grammy nominations went prime time this year. Could the star-studded event lure viewers back to watch the awards? Here to get us up to speed on all of that and more is Allison Samuels, a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Allison, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
So, OJ, 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 yes. 15 years.
Yes.
What do you say?
I say that I think this is a moment for history because so many people felt that he got off the last time. That I think a lot of people feel like this is just sort of the circle, you know, just sort of coming back around.
You know, well, it's hard to come up with the right words, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And to see him earlier this morning crying, you know, pleading, sort of apologizing for everything that happened, it just really did take you back to, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, 13 years ago, I think, when he was actually acquitted. And, you know, he seemed certainly sorrowful, but I just think, you know, America has just been listening and living with this guy for so long that they're sort of tired of him. I don't think he has that same type of sympathy that he got the last time, particularly from the African-American community.
It's really interesting. We had a previous conversation about multiculturalism and diversity, mm-hmm. and O.J. Simpson certainly played a part in that a decade ago, and
definitely.
This is the coda
yeah.
to that, I guess would be one way of putting that. Let's talk about something else.
Okay.
Michelle Obama, mm-hmm. you had a big cover story in Newsweek. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Last week titled, What Michelle Means to Us. What kind of response? I saw that it was one of the top viewed pieces at Newsweek.
Yes, we got a great response. You know, we also had, you know, some negative response as well. I think that goes along with the territory. But a lot of response, I mean, particularly from, I think, younger people, younger African Americans, younger minorities overall, just sort of saying what, you know, how inspirational it was. And that because so many of us don't fit into that mold of what it's termed beauty in this country. And to see someone like her on the cover of a magazine who, you know, she has a model frame. She has all the things that models sort of have, but just not that traditional look. So I think it was inspirational for a lot of young people, which is great.
You wrote something that was interesting. I'd like to ask you to respond to it. Here's your quote. Michelle will be a daily reminder that we are not all hot-headed, foaming at the mouth, drug addicts, always ready with a quick one-liner and a roll of the eyes. Is that an image of black women that you think still dominates?
I think so, particularly in pop culture. I think, you know, on television, I made a point in one of my recent articles, you have to go back to Claire Huxtable to find a very dominant, visible African-American female character that had a positive background. I mean, you just don't see it. And I think that as long as you don't have that daily reminder or weekly reminder of that there's so many different types of African-American women and men, that stereotype is going to continue. But I do think with Michelle Obama out there constantly, you know, people are going to sort of, you know, take a step back and sort of look and say, okay, what am I missing here? I'm not including the entire group of people here. Let me think about that.
Let me throw you a curve, okay? There was an issue about whether or not Michelle Obama would be on the cover of Vogue
yeah.
or the cover of either Essence or Ebony
right.
first as the first
mm-hmm.
lady. Mm-hmm. Was that resolved?
It's no, not yet. It's still they had a great she will be on the cover of Essence. She and Barack will be on the cover of Essence. I think that what the problem is that they don't want her to be seen as the fashionista. I think they're very concerned about Michelle's people.
Mm-hmm.
I think they don't want that to come off as, and I think Vogue, you know, obviously is primarily a fashion magazine, whereas Essence and Ebony, you can truly get into some issues and get into some policy things, whereas you can't do it so much with Vogue. And I think they're very concerned about her not sort of just being viewed as this fashion plate because, you know, she does have a Harvard degree. She is a lawyer. And I think that's smart on some level to sort of be careful about how she's actually viewed, particularly so early.
One last White House mm-hmm. question. Her mother mm-hmm. moving into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's been a mother-in-law in the White House in a long, long time.
Very long time. Yeah. I mean, I think that would be great because I think the girls have, their children have certainly depended on her in these last 2 years when their parents went around doing the campaign. And also, I think it is a sort of extension of what black families do around the country. I mean, the grandparents have a really big role in a lot of their grandkids' lives. So I'm hoping that it will happen because I think it'll be a great, you know, thing for the kids.
All right, let's go from Washington to Hollywood. I was flipping the TV the other night and
mm-hmm.
I stopped at CBS not knowing that it was on, but
right.
the Grammy nominations concert. And
mm-hmm.
so I sat there, my wife and I, and we watched it. The Grammys, of course, have sputtered in recent years, but last February, their worst in ever, I guess, their
yeah.
third worst show ever. So this new thing with this concert It actually got 7 million viewers. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an interesting idea.
I think it's an interesting idea, and I think we have to remember with this economy, people aren't going out as much. People are going to be home watching their TV. So I think, you know, it's a smart idea to do right now because the music industry is still struggling. But I do think with the economy as it is, people are going to have some free time where they're going to have to fill it up, and watching TV is going to be one way.
Well, as I told you, I was flipping it, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what I caught when I landed on the channel, and it made me stay there. Listen to this.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let me take me. Don't let him handle.
That's Christina Aguilera. She was performing, and I'm like, man, what is this? It was great.
No, it was really amazing to just sort of see it, and she sounded so great. She's, you know, she has a wonderful voice. I think, you know, the wonderful part about that is that they're giving people a diversity. I think the music industry has been stuck so long in this sort of one, you know, just one sort of sound that now it's like, okay, we have this captive audience because of the economy. People mm-hmm. will be sitting down and looking at television. How do we sort of utilize that for the best? And I think the way they're doing it is just sort of giving diversity, and that was one taste of it.
Well, we'll see. February is when the Grammy Awards show is coming up. Another topic, tragic, actually, Jennifer Hudson, you know, picking up 4 Grammy nods mm-hmm. that particular night at the same time that they make an arrest in the murders of her family. I understand, though, that she has really been getting a great deal of support from some high-level celebrities like Oprah Winfrey and others.
Oprah Winfrey, Quincy Jones. I spoke to Quincy last week, and he was saying he'd spoken to her, reached out to her, and just asked her, did she need anything? Sarah Jessica Parker, who she was in Sex and the City. I mean, everyone has sort of reached out to her. And I mean, how can you not in this particular kind of situation? I think anybody who doesn't have some type of sympathy for someone who's gone through this, I don't know how you could not reach out to someone like her.
I guess one of the questions that fans would have, and I would put myself in that category, is, you know, how do you bounce back from that, and how do you perform, and how do you do your work and your job and pursue your career with such a heavy, heavy heart?
Well, I think for Jennifer, since I think her mother was a huge influence on her and, you know, was really supportive of her career, I would hope that she would sort of think about, you know, this is what her mother would want her to do, is sort of continue that career, continue to shine. Her mother did get to see a great deal of her success. She saw her win the Oscar. So I have to feel that that is what she's going to have to rely on to sort of make it, you know, through the rest of her career.
All right. One more topic. Mm-hmm. This is great. I love having you on here because you know everything about Hollywood. all these Will Smith, yeah. You know, billboards everywhere,
right.
And the trailers for this new movie called 7 Pounds. Mm-hmm. And you know how they promote films now.
Right.
You don't know what the heck the film is about.
Right.
You've been talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
So fill us in.
Well, I can't tell you what the film was about. I mean, I've seen it, but you can't tell the ending because the ending is the part that they really just want you to know. But he's definitely in this bittersweet mode. I mean, if you've seen the last few Will Smith movies, Pursuit of Happiness, I Am Legend, they're all sort of, you know, a little down. He said he's in this bittersweet moment where he's trying to figure out how life doesn't always give you exactly what you want. You can be doing really, really well, as he is, but still not have everything exactly the way you want. And it was an interesting conversation because I asked him why, you know, is something bittersweet in your life right now? And the only thing he could talk about was his grandmother, who I guess died from a stroke a couple of years ago, and how he never really dealt with that tragedy in his life. And that these films have been a great outlet, for really digging deep and sort of getting into that pain. So
you know, we can never know what goes on in a person's personal life, but it's hard to imagine what Will Smith could possibly need.
Well, that's true. But I mean, I think when you have things like death, we all go through that, and there's just no comfort for that other than, and he said that he really didn't deal with it. He didn't cry at the funeral. He just really felt like, oh, you know, she's in a better place now. And I think we all deal with, you know, pain and suffering in different ways. And his, I think, is to bring it out, you know, in his films.
Now, sometimes in these interviews, things don't make it into the page.
Right.
They don't make it onto the air.
Right.
I know there's something that you talked about with Will that did not make it in the interview. What was it that's good that you could share with us?
Well, I mean, he said so many things, but I mean, because he talked a lot about his friendship with Tom Cruise. He talked about his son, Jaden, who's going to be doing Karate Kid, which I thought was interesting. And he's producing it. And I was asking him just sort of like, how do you deal with your kids being these celebrities? How do you sort of keep them grounded. And his sort of point was he thinks he's becoming more and more like his father, being a little bit too stern, being a little bit too sort of hands-on. And that, you know, that's something he's sort of really trying to deal with his kids. Like, do you really want to do this? Or, you know, am I pushing you too hard? And, you know, it's funny. He's really sat back and sort of thought about what kind of parent am I being right now.
Is he the highest paid actor in Hollywood right now?
Right now, yes, he is. And it's going to be interesting to see what 7 Pounds does, because it's a difficult movie to market, which you've sort of seen. So I don't know if this is going to have the box office receipts that many movies of his have had before, and particularly, again, with the recession. I don't know. That's going to be interesting. I think that's going to be a test of his star power, and I think he knows that as well.
Now, he's not going to be talking to a dog again in the movie, is he?
No. There's no dog in this movie. No, there is a dog in this movie. I'm sorry. There is a dog, and he does talk to it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
He has to have a dog.
Allison, thank you so
much.
That was Allison Samuels, a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She joined us right here in the studios of NPR West in Culver City.